Welcome to the reading of the Worcester Business Journal. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Today, we will be reading from the latest edition. This program is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. This is Joanne with Paul, reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And now I'll hand it over to Paul.
Thank you, Joanne, and good morning to our listeners. Our first story, from the Chamber Corner, Massachusetts must opt into the federal scholarship tax credit. Massachusetts has earned its reputation as a leader in education by prioritizing investment in our students and schools. The newly enacted federal scholarship tax credit program, set to take effect on January 1st, presents an opportunity to build on this foundation by injecting new resources into our educational ecosystem. However, this opportunity is not automatic. Governor Maura Healey must officially opt in to secure these funds and ensure the Commonwealth does not miss a vital window for educational advancement. The mechanics of the program are simple but transformative. Any taxpayer can donate up to $1,700 to an approved nonprofit scholarship granting organization and receive a dollar-for-dollar federal tax credit. Projections show this could generate an estimated $660 million annually, bringing up to $1 billion in tax credit eligible gifts to Massachusetts over its first 3 years. Crucially, this represents 100% new federal funding that will not increase state spending nor diminish public school budgets. While some have characterized the program as a private school voucher initiative, that perspective overlooks the substantial benefits available to public school students. Whereas families earning up to 300% of the area median income are eligible, roughly 90% of Massachusetts residents qualify. Families can utilize these funds for vital supplemental services, including academic tutoring, special education therapies, after-school programs, and technology. Furthermore, this influx of capital would drastically expand the capacity of community pillars like the YMCA and Boys and Girls Clubs, where the demand for out-of-school care outstrips supply 2-to-1. Further, our local employers face a persistent need for a robust talent pipeline. These scholarships can directly fund career and technical education, apprenticeships, and dual enrollment programs. If the state fails to act, our workforce and business community will miss out on a special opportunity to train the next generation of skilled workers. Refusing to participate would place Massachusetts at a competitive disadvantage within New England. While New Hampshire has already opted in, if the Commonwealth declines to participate, our taxpayers' dollars will simply be redirected to fund students in other states or absorbed back into the U.S. Treasury. Rejecting this federal support would mirror the costly policy mistakes of states that turned away the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion, leaving their own constituents underserved. By opting in, Massachusetts stands to capture a significant economic and educational advantage, securing vital resources that would otherwise be left on the table. Choosing this path aligns the Commonwealth with fellow Democratic leaders, including the governors of Colorado and North Carolina, who have already joined, and New York's Governor Kathy Hochul, who has announced her intent to do the same. With 68% of Massachusetts voters supporting participation, the mandate is clear. Governor Healey and state leaders should put students, families, and our future workforce first by fully embracing the federal scholarship tax credit. And the Chamber Corner was brought to us today by Timothy Murray, President and CEO of the Greater Worcester Chamber of Commerce. Moving on to our next story, Q&A. Luis Pedreja on the QCC legacy he leaves behind. When Luis Pedreja arrived at Quinsigamond Community College in 2017, the institution faced declining enrollment and financial challenges. Nearly a decade later, enrollment has rebounded, student support services have expanded, and the college has secured major investments to strengthen its future. As Pedreja prepares to retire next year, he reflects on the goals that shaped his presidency. What was the biggest impact you made in your time as QCC president? Everything comes back to the students. My North Star has always been student success because education transformed my own life as a first-generation college student, immigrant who came out of an inner city, and an English language learner. When I think of how much education transformed my life, how it opened doors for me, and how, back when I was growing up in inner city Miami, if you had told me I'd be president of a college in Massachusetts one day, I probably wouldn't have believed it. But my parents always told me to study hard because you can lose everything, but you can never lose your education. One of the accomplishments I'm most proud of is strengthening the support systems around our students. We expanded counseling services, developed a robust food pantry in partnership with the community, created workforce development opportunities, and opened our first generation student support center. What were the goals of your presidency when you started the job? Well, I had three goals. The first was improving student success. I often told people we wouldn't stop until we reached 100% student success. Some would say that's impossible, but my point was that we should never stop working to remove barriers for students. The second goal was stabilizing enrollment. When I joined QCC in 2017, enrollment had been declining, so we focused on retention and making sure students had the support they needed to stay in school. We have stabilized, and thanks to the free community college efforts from the governor and the state legislature, we've been able to increase our enrollment numbers. Last fall, we had 9,000 students, a significant increase. The third goal was strengthening the college's financial position by diversifying revenue sources. We increased grant funding, expanded workforce development partnerships, invested in campus infrastructure, and maintained strong financial resources. Were you able to accomplish everything you set out to do? Overall, I believe we did. The pandemic certainly interrupted everyone's plans, but because we had already built momentum before COVID-19, we were able to recover. Today, the college is financially stable, enrollment is growing, and major projects like the new student center are helping. The timing of my retirement was intentional. We're beginning to work on the next strategic plan, and I wanted to give the next president an opportunity to help shape that vision. What surprised you most? The weight of the decisions. One lesson I learned is that credit rolls down and blame rolls up. Success belongs to the faculty, staff, and employees who do the work every day. As a leader, your responsibility is to make the difficult decisions and accept accountability for them. What do you see as your legacy? The most meaningful recognition I've received wasn't an award. It was hearing from students after I announced my retirement. Several wrote to tell me how the college or something I'd said made a difference in their lives. That's what matters most to me. What matters are the students whose lives and their families' lives have been changed through education. I've always believed leadership isn't measured by how long you stay. It's measured by the legacy you leave behind and whether you've positioned the institution to succeed after you're gone. For our next story, WPI receives $1.5 million from federal government to build contamination destruction reactor. Worcester Polytechnic Institute has received a $1.5 million federal funding grant to build a continuous flow reactor designed to destroy PFAS in contaminated soil. The funding was allocated through community project funding in the fiscal 2026 federal appropriations process, according to an announcement last Tuesday from Congressman Jim McGovern. McGovern has advocated for more than $12 million in similar funding for projects around his congressional district. PFAS, often called forever chemicals, have been linked to developmental problems, immune system suppression, and increased risks of certain cancers, according to McGovern's office. The funding aims to move the PFAS destruction technology closer to real-world deployment, with the goal of fighting contamination both locally and beyond. McGovern visited WPI last Thursday to formally announce the funding. Next, Marlboro Flex Buildings sold to Boston firm for $28.2 million. A Boston-based real estate firm has purchased two Flex industrial buildings in Marlboro's Cedar Hill Business Park for $28.15 million as part of a larger investment targeting industrial properties in supply-constrained Northeast submarkets. Sayon Group purchased 261 Cedar Hill Street and 753 Forest Street in two separate deals finalized last Friday, according to Middlesex South Registry of Deeds records. The purchase came amid the firm's launch of Scion Industrial Fund II, an investment vehicle focused on acquiring, operating, and upgrading small bay multi-tenant industrial properties. The Marlboro purchase came amid the fund's acquisition of an 11-building industrial complex in East Hartford, Connecticut, and a 2-building industrial property in Capitol Heights, Maryland, Scion announced. The firm said its interest in the properties came from their location in densely populated areas, barriers to new supply, and the diversity of the building's tenants. Both of the Marlboro sites are fully leased. Scion Industrial Fund II had raised $29.28 million from investors as of July 21, according to filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Scion Group was founded in 2017 and has a portfolio totaling more than 5.5 million square feet, according to its website. The 75,000-square-foot building at 753 Forest Street was constructed in 1986, according to real estate data firm CoStar. The site features four separate 18,750-square-foot spaces, with tenants including digital display manufacturer Canvas, a Volkswagen Audi learning center, and measuring instrument supplier Mitutoyo America Corp., according to Google Maps listings. The 59,404-square-foot building at 261 Cedar Hill Street was built in 1987, with spaces ranging from 5,000 to 14,500 square feet. Tenants at the building include HVAC contractor Endless Energy and engineering firm Cortec. Both sites were purchased from Westwood-based True Associates, which had paid a combined $18.1 million for them in 2018. The parcel at 261 Cedar Hill Street, received a 2026 assessment of $10.8 million, while 753 Forest Street was assessed at $11.43 million, according to City of Marlboro property records. Next, former Worcester Academy ball fields slated for 207-unit housing complex. A Connecticut-based real estate firm is proposing a 207-unit housing development on athletics fields owned by Worcester Academy, including 26 multi-unit townhouses and a 57-unit apartment building. 232 Stafford LLC, an entity sharing an address and a manager with Fairfield-based Connecticut Realty Trust, is proposing the project for the 36.6-acre site at 232 Stafford Street. The proposal calls for the construction of 150 units spread across the 26 townhouse buildings, with 71,088-square-foot four-story apartment building near the entrance of the site. The application filed with the Worcester Zoning Board of Appeals seeks a special permit allowing for parking layout requirements and variances to provide relief from the city's maximum height requirements and minimum frontage requirements for the property. The project is not slated to include any affordable units, with developers instead planning on making a payment to the Worcester Affordable Housing Trust Fund. While still listed as an athletic facility on Worcester Academy's website, the site is for sale, according to an online listing with Worcester-based real estate brokerage Kelleher and Sadowski Associates. The property has a listing price of $4.5 million, with Will Kelleher and Drew Higgins serving as the listing brokers. Worcester Academy opened New Balance Performance Park, an athletic complex on its main campus, in October 2025. Plans call for the construction of 152 parking spaces, new internal driveways, a pool, and other site improvements. Currently owned by the nonprofit trustees of Worcester Academy, a sale to a private entity would bring the property back onto the city's tax rolls. CT Realty Trust was founded in 2009 by Bard and Robert Kligerman, with the goal of acquiring distressed multifamily assets in the wake of the financial crisis, according to the firm's website. The company has since expanded into other investments, including ground-up developments. Mark Borenstein, partner at the Worcester office of Boston-based law firm Prince Lobel Tye, is representing 232 Stafford for this project. The ZBA application is set to be heard at the board's August 10th meeting. And now we'll take a short break.
Did you know that there are many different ways to listen to Audio Journal? You can go to our website, audiojournal.org and stream us live. Or you can install the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. Or you can tell your smart speaker to play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or you can dial us at 1-712-770-1043 on your telephone. Or you can turn on your local cable access TV station. You can check our website, audiojournal.org, for the correct channel for your town. And finally, you can use one of our special receivers tuned to Audio Journal's frequency. And if you missed your favorite program, go to our website or the Audio Journal app and listen to podcasts of previously aired programs. Now, if you need assistance with any of these listening methods, please contact us at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Welcome back to the reading of the Worcester Business Journal. It is 11:16 a.m. Premiums, drug prices targeted in health affordability push. Governor Maura Healey unveiled long-promised health care affordability recommendations to expand MassHealth's investment in primary care, slash premiums, rein in out-of-network cost, mitigate low-value care, leverage state buying power to reduce prescription drug cost, initiate an artificial intelligence regulatory process, and more. Healey intends to sign an executive order requiring that MassHealth invest 12% of its total medical spending into primary care by 2028, the governor's office said. In 2024, 8.4% of MassHealth spending was dedicated to primary care, according to a state dashboard. House and Senate bills mapping out a primary care spending target were sent to conference committee talks last Friday. Negotiators must figure out how quickly they want primary care to account for 15% of total health care spending, which entities would be subject to that target, and what enforcement mechanisms would entail. Healey voiced her support for that legislation as her office promoted an initial slate of 12 recommendations from the Healthcare Affordability Workgroup that met confidentially for months and gave scant insight until now about its effort to solve one of the Commonwealth's biggest cost of living issues. The governor announced the group's creation at a Statehouse press conference on January 14, saying she wanted to see some actual changes and recommendations no later than June. In the meantime, Bay Staters are grappling with double-digit premium increases, high deductible health plans that are triggering steep out-of-pocket cost, and tough decisions to delay care due to affordability woes. We brought together leaders with different perspectives and expertise because everyone agreed on one thing. We have to make health care more affordable, Healey said in a statement. These recommendations give us a roadmap to lower cost, strengthen our workforce, and make sure people can continue getting the high-quality care they deserve. Healey said she's directing the Division of Insurance to establish default out-of-network payment rates. The effort is meant to protect patients from surprise bills after they unknowingly receive care from providers who aren't in their insurance networks, her office said. The DOI will hold listening sessions as it develops proposed regulations. Healey is also charging the DOI to evaluate bold new strategies to strengthen competition and reduce premium costs in the merged market. The governor's office. Nearly 700,000 Bay Staters will see an average premium hike of 10.4% under rates regulators recently approved for 2027 in the merged market, where many individuals and small businesses get coverage. Insurance Commissioner Michael Calgiel says the status quo is unacceptable. Prescription drugs, including expensive specialty drugs, are a top driver for health care spending growth. The work group wants the Executive Office of Health and Human Services, the Massachusetts Health Connector, and the Group Insurance Commission and the Health Policy Commission to collaborate and develop a coordinated strategy for leveraging the state's purchasing power in order to lower drug costs and improve access to medications. Officials at the GIC, which stopped coverage for costly GLP-1 drugs for weight loss, have suggested a similar coordinated approach could help drive down the price tag for the popular drugs. The group work wants the GIC, which provides coverage for more than 460,000 state workers and retirees, to play a role in managing hospital prices and lowering cost. Healy's office says the GIC will set standards for fair prices for some services without limiting where members receive care, which undisclosed actions expected in the coming months. The administration did not point to specific solutions, but noted prices can vary widely between hospitals, even for the same services and treatments, which drives up premiums for everyone. The HPC is tasked with overseeing a new clinical expert committee to tackle what the administration describes as low-value or inappropriate services that don't necessarily improve patients' health outcomes. The committee will help develop goals, reporting requirements, and accountability mechanisms for reducing those services, as well as offer payment incentives to discourage inappropriate and costly care, the Healy administration said. Nearly one in four commercially insured residents received at least one of 17 low-value services tracked by the HPC, which translates into about $62 million in health care spending. Between 2022 and 2024, low-value service use climbed across four major categories: tests and procedures, imaging, drugs, and screenings, according to data discussed at a recent HPC meeting. The work group has also advised shoring up the state's health information exchange system, enabling more information to be shared privately across hospitals, doctors, and insurers. The group plans to bring together healthcare data and technology experts to produce a data exchange framework and roadmap. Mirroring guardrails embedded in the House's primary care bill, the Healy administration said it intends to create an AI advisory work group as insurers and healthcare providers increasingly use artificial intelligence for coding, claims review, and coverage decisions. Massachusetts should establish clear rules and transparency around how AI is used in these healthcare processes so decisions are fair, accountable, and do not cause errors, unfair denials, or delays in care, Healy's office said. Additionally, affordability recommendations are broader, with some building upon recent grant funding. The Healy administration, for example, said it's instructing state agencies to work with the healthcare providers, health plans, and experts to develop and deploy a strategy for accelerating the adoption of innovative care models and technologies. Those models can reduce hospital or ED visits, Healy's office said. The HPC recently announced $1.38 million for seven hospitals aimed at supporting hospital-to-home programs and streamlining patient discharges to their homes rather than into skilled nursing facilities. In another attempt to mitigate the clogged discharge process from acute care hospitals, the Healy administration said it will explore actions for modernizing surrogate decision-making and healthcare proxy laws. When patients remain stuck in acute care hospitals, they face added harm. Hospitals lose capacity and costs rise. Haley's office said. Patients should be able to move smoothly to the next step in their care, not wait because of paperwork, approvals, or bed shortages. Without attaching concrete dollar figures, the administration said it is eyeing investments for nursing faculty recruitment and retention. Nursing programs are currently turning applicants away since they lack sufficient faculty and classroom capacity. Under potential consideration are scholarships, loan forgiveness, and other approaches that lower financial barriers for nursing faculty. To address broader health care workforce shortages, the administration said it will build on its investments in training primary care providers, nurses, long-term care staff, behavioral health workers, and community health workers. The affordability work group met privately for months, and the Executive Office of Health and Human Services has not shared meeting minutes or other materials with the news service. Other special commissions operate more transparently, including the Health Policy Commission Primary Care Task Force that broadcast its meeting on YouTube and posted presentations on its website. Health and Human Services Secretary Kiam Mahania told the news service in March that he was expecting meaty recommendations to emerge between June and December. The group is particularly interested in recommendations that can be put into law, as well as things that don't need legislation because those are easier to do in a short period of time, the secretary had said. Healy is at the Cape Cod Hospital on Monday to announce the recommendations. Next article. Framingham firm lands $69.5 million Death Valley contract. Perini Management Services has been awarded $69.5 million contract to renovate water and wastewater systems in America's hottest and driest national park. The Framingham-based subsidiary of California's Tudor Perini Corp. has been selected by the National Park Service to upgrade Death Valley's National Park's water and wastewater treatment systems, some of which date back to the 1960s. The three-year project is set to commence this fall, the company announced. The water systems at Death Valley have required repairs about once a week in recent years, while wastewater failures have caused sewage spills and campground closures, according to an NPS announcement. The extreme conditions at the park increase maintenance demands on infrastructure. The project involves rehabilitating water systems at Cow Creek and Furnace Creek, the two main hubs of the park, as well as wastewater system jointly used by both locations. Funding for the upgrades was provided by the Great American Outdoors Act, signed into law by President Donald Trump in 2020. Work by Perini Management will include replacing mains and pump stations, as well as creating new water wells and improving the capacity of the park's lagoon. The improvements will benefit the park's 1.7 million annual visitors and local residents. The Perini Corp. was founded in 1894 by Bonfiglio Perini, an Italian immigrant who resided in Framingham. According to the Framingham History Center, Perini Corp. merged with Tutor Saliba Corp. in 2008 and moved its headquarters to Los Angeles in 2009. Perini Management secured a contract worth $48.6 million to rehabilitate the main prison building on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay in 2024. And now it's time for another break.
When my dad started to lose his vision, we were worried. Sure, his doctor gave me and my mom some handouts, and I did my fair share of research. But we had no idea how much of a challenge vision loss would be, or how it would impact his quality of life. That's why I was so glad we discovered Mass Commission for the Blind. They work with my dad, and they will work with you and your loved one as well, to develop future plans and new skills and assistive technology. They even help Dad get access to talking books and newspapers. He was so excited.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Welcome back to the weekly reading of the Worcester Business Journal. It is 11:30 a.m., and this reading is a production of Audio Journal. Our next story, Avidia Bancorp, quarterly profits rise 20% on higher fee income. Hudson-based Avidia Bancorp reported second quarter net income of $7.2 million, a 20% increase from the first quarter, as growth in fee income helped offset flat net interest income. The parent company of Avidia Bank earned 39 cents per diluted share for the quarter ended June 30, up from $6 million or 32 cents per share in the first quarter. The bank reported total net revenue rose 6% to $29.9 million, driven by higher customer service fees and payment processing income. Earnings growth of 20% quarter over quarter reflected increases in most categories of fee income, CEO Robert Cozzone said in a press release accompanying the earnings report. Avidia reported total assets of $2.78 billion as of June 30, down 1% from the prior quarter, while deposits increased by 0.3% to $2.15 billion. The company announced a 20% increase in its quarterly cash dividend to 6 cents per share. The company's stock was trading at $21.84 per share a week or two ago on the New York Stock Exchange, up about 8% for that day. Moving on to our next story, from the Advice Desk, five things Massachusetts employers should know about using AI in hiring. Artificial intelligence is changing the way companies hire new employees. Many employers are turning to technology like automated resume screeners, chatbots, and video interview tools to help sort through job applications and choose the best candidates more efficiently. These tools promise speed and convenience, and in some cases, they can reduce human bias, but they also come with significant risks, especially in fairness and discrimination. In Washington, D.C. and on Beacon Hill, lawmakers and regulators are trying to fit AI policy into the existing anti-discrimination legal framework, which includes Title VII protections, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. These developments do not eliminate employers' legal obligations to comply with federal anti-discrimination laws. In Massachusetts, the Attorney General's Office issued an advisory in 2024 emphasizing that users of AI in the Commonwealth must adhere to anti-discrimination laws. The advisory makes clear employers are prohibited from using AI that discriminates on the basis of a protected characteristic. Pending proposals in the legislature, like Senate Bill S-35 and its House counterpart H-77 and Senate Docket 3007 collectively reflect growing momentum toward regulating automated decision systems and employment. Employers in Massachusetts should monitor these developments closely. So, what does this mean for Massachusetts employers? If your company is already using or thinking about using AI in any part of the hiring process, now is a good time to review how those tools work and whether they could be causing unintended results. Here are five steps you can take. First, understand the tools you are using. Take time to learn how your AI systems operate, including what data they rely on and how they make decisions. If you don't understand how a tool works, it may be harder to identify potential risks. Second, work with your vendors. If you are using third-party AI tools, ask vendors how they test their systems for bias and whether they conduct regular audits. Make sure you are comfortable with the safeguards in place. Number three, look for signs of bias. Review your hiring data. Are certain groups of applicants rejected more often than others? AI might be reinforcing bias. Number four, be upfront with applicants. Let candidates know if AI is being used in their application process and explain how it works. Transparency builds trust, and it might soon be legally required. And finally, at number 5, keep humans in the loop. Even if AI is used to help with decision-making, make sure a real person reviews important choices. Don't let software make final hiring decisions. AI can be a helpful tool, but it isn't perfect. It can sometimes reflect and repeat the same unfair patterns that already exist in society. Employers must stay alert and informed to make sure these technologies support non-discriminatory hiring, not undermine it. This column is by Laura M. Raisty, and she is a partner at Worcester law firm Bowditch & Dewey, where she counsels and defends employers and matters related to employer-employee relationships. For our next story, we'll take a look at some of the people in the movers and shakers category. First up, Giselle Rivera Flores. She has joined Worcester Community Action Council as Chief External Affairs Officer. Rivera Flores brings more than 15 years of communications experience to the newly created role. She most recently served as Communications Director for Massachusetts Senator Robin Kennedy of Worcester and holds a master's degree in organizational psychology. Next, we have Katie Chappell. She has been promoted to Deputy Director for Museum Operations at the Ecotarium in Worcester. Chappell previously served as the museum's Director of Education, Exhibits, and Collections. Before joining the Ecotarium in 2021, she held leadership roles with Girl Scouts of Central and Western Massachusetts and the Springfield Boys and Girls Clubs. Next, Robert O'Brien has been named Vice President, Commercial Relationship Manager at Clinton Savings Bank. O'Brien has more than 15 years of commercial banking experience. In this role, he will focus on building and strengthening relationships with business clients throughout Worcester County. O'Brien holds an MBA from Suffolk University and resides in Millbury, where he serves as a board member for the town's redevelopment authority. Next, Patricia Reinhart and Paul Nasser have been appointed to the board of directors of Framingham-based Mutual One Bank. Reinhart is managing partner of advisory firm Tiller & Company and will chair the board's compensation committee while serving on its security committee. She earned a master's degree in public administration from Harvard's Kennedy School in Cambridge and a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Nasser is president of Intercontinental Real Estate Corp and will chair the board's security committee while serving on its compensation committee. He earned an MBA from Suffolk University in Boston and a bachelor's degree in urban planning from the University of Rhode Island in Kingston, Rhode Island. Next, Elizabeth Thompson has been elected president of the Board of Directors at YWCA Central Massachusetts in Worcester. Thompson is assistant vice president of professional and executive lines delegated distribution at Worcester-based The Hanover Insurance Group. She earned a degree in economics from Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley and is a graduate of Leadership Worcester. Tracy Lemaire has been appointed to the board of directors of Auburn-based Bank Webster 5. Lemaire is the founder of Evolved CPA Consulting and previously spent 11 years at Westboro-based AAF CPAs. She earned a bachelor's degree in business administration and accounting from the University of New Hampshire and an MBA from Bryant University in Smithfield, Rhode Island. Gary Reed has joined Northbridge-based ERA Key Realty Services as a realtor in the firm's Auburn office. Reed previously served as call center manager for Charter Communication in Worcester. He is a graduate of Freedom Trail Realty School in Boston and serves as state coordinator of the Newfoundland Club of New England Rescue. Littleton-based Hanscom Federal Credit Union has been granted preferred lender status by the U.S. Small Business Administration. The designation gives the credit union authority to make SBA loan decisions in-house, which can streamline approvals for small business borrowers. And finally, Natick-based Middlesex Savings Bank has named Kirsten Madsen, Senior Vice President and Director of Cash Management and Payment Services, and promoted Brian Hanley to Senior Vice President and Director of Business Banking. Madsen most recently served as Vice President of Consumer Bank Territory Operations at Flagstar Bank. Hanley has been with Middlesex Savings Bank for 17 years and previously served as Senior Vice President and Business Banking Team Leader. For our next story, Saint-Gobain expands Northboro presence with $30 million fire lab. Saint-Gobain North America has opened its new fire testing laboratory, the latest expansion of its Innovation Hub North America campus in Northboro. The lab is designed to test Saint-Gobain's construction material products for fire certification standards. Bringing these capabilities in-house will allow the France-based conglomerate to be more nimble in research, development, and innovation, the company announced. This is a strategic investment, Ann Hardy Group Chief Innovation Officer at Saint-Gobain said at the recent ribbon cutting for the $30 million lab. It's one that's well appreciated globally across the company and clearly recognized as an important building block of what we need for these sustainable solutions across the country. Saint-Gobain designated the Northboro facility as one of its five global innovation hubs in June. The campus is expected to employ 400 people when fully completed. The 15,000-square-foot facility features two large furnaces. One furnace is meant to test vertical components like walls, while the other meant to test horizontal components such as ceilings. The facility's state-of-the-art emission system will prevent any odors or impacts to the surrounding community, according to Saint-Gobain. Construction began in the lab in October 2024 and was led by Milford-based Consigli Construction. It comes as part of a broader, decade-long expansion to the campus used by Saint-Gobain since the 1980s. The fire lab joins existing acoustic and weather testing capabilities at the campus, part of Saint-Gobain's efforts to offer testing of commercial construction products. The 26-acre campus spans across both Northboro and Marlboro, but as a Northboro address, Saint-Gobain received a tax credit worth $195,000 from Northboro in 2025. Headquartered just outside Paris, Saint-Gobain has 162,000 employees across locations in 81 countries, bringing in $53.63 billion in sales in 2025. The company has 1,200 employees in central Massachusetts, according to information provided to the Worcester Business Journal Research Department, with two sites in Worcester serving as additional parts of its local footprint. Originally a mirror manufacturer, Saint-Gobain traces its roots back to 1665. For our next story, McGovern Auto buys historic Uxbridge Mill for $3.3 million to expand municipal vehicle division. A month after Newton-based McGovern Auto Group purchased the site of its Marlboro headquarters for its specialty police, fire, and municipal vehicle business, the firm is growing its truck equipment production space with the purchase of an historic Uxbridge Mill. An entity managed by McGovern purchased 44 Rivulet Street for $3.3 million on July 13, according to Worcester District Registry of Deeds records. The vacant site is part of the historic Rivulet Mill Complex, a 19th century textile plant. McGovern's purchase of both the Uxbridge and Marlboro facilities was supported by $13.6 million in financing from the Washington Trust Company, according to a recent announcement from the Rhode Island-based bank. The move to the 131,000-square-foot facility in Uxbridge will replace a leased space utilized by municipal vehicle upfitter McGovern MHQ in Oxford. Renovations at the new site will allow MHQ to expand its operating capacity to serve municipal governments across the Northeast, according to Washington Trust. The site dates back to 1814, according to the Massachusetts Historical Commission. Originally producing textiles, the mill later made knitting yarn, cotton wraps, and satinettes. The original mill was replaced in the 1870s after it was destroyed by a fire. MHQ has outfitted more than 100,000 municipal vehicles since the firm was founded in 1979, according to its website. The firm was acquired by McGovern Auto Group in 2023. McGovern purchased the site from Rivulet LLC, an Uxbridge-based entity managed by Mark Vanderbon and Benjamin Michelson. The parcel received a 2026 assessment of $2.98 million. And now for another short break.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
Welcome back to the reading of the Worcester Business Journal. House votes unanimously to direct more funds to primary care. Bay State is scrambling to book an appointment with a primary care physician may eventually see relief under a sprawling bill the House passed to significantly boost investment in the sector. House Speaker Ron Mariano previously scoffed at the Senate's primary care bill, S-3141, saying senators passed their version last month without any idea of how much it was going to cost. But the House bill, H-5618, which passed on a 158-0 vote just before 10 p.m., ultimately incorporates the two major hallmarks of the Senate approach, setting an aggregate primary care spending target and embracing a new payment model that moves away from the typical fee-for-service structure. The House envisions the state gradually spending 15% of all health care dollars on primary care by 2036, while the Senate wants to reach the percentage much sooner by 2030. Currently, just 6.6% of total commercial health care expenditures flow toward primary care, according to a dashboard from the Center for Health Information and Analysis. The bill before us aims to address this problem. It does so incrementally, increasing the expenditures to 9% in 2023, 12% in 2033, and 15% ultimately in 2036, Representative Greg Schwartz, a primary care physician, said during his inaugural speech on the House floor. That's a gradual increase over 10 years, the Newton Democrat continued. It's a significant increase in the primary care portion, but still a relatively small proportion compared to the whole. And it's done at a pace under this bill that gives our provider networks and insurers payers enough time to adjust their contracts with guidance from the state to achieve these goals smoothly. The House bill features only an aggregate primary care spending goal. The Senate also wants individual health care entities to reach the target. Mariano asked how he became comfortable with the House's approach to the primary care reform, pointed to the longer glide path for reaching the target, and said the bill differentiates between safety net hospitals and teaching hospitals. We make allowances for the different situations that different hospitals are in. Some are financially a little bit better off than others, so they can pay to increase the public health outreach that other hospitals can't afford to do, Mariano told reporters after a private Democrat caucus. So we make it fairer. We put some options in there that will count for participation and increasing in public participation that aren't financial, like hiring an extra nurse to keep your health center open another couple hours. The House bill outlines a process for the Health Policy Commission to require so-called primary care commitments from health care entities that are exceeding the state's cost growth benchmark. Exempt from those commitments are physicians, contracting units with patient panels at 15,000 or fewer, or units that represent providers earning less than $25 million in annual net patient service revenue. CHIA would be tasked with reviewing healthcare entities' investments in primary care. CHIA would take into account whether the entity serves as a disproportionate share of patients on public insurance and whether its limited capacity to boost investment in primary care is due to the entity's payer mix, financial condition, or the acuity of the population it treats. Democratic Rep. John Lawn, co-chair of the Health Care Financing Committee, did not deliver opening floor remarks or join Mariano at the post-caucus scrum. A Mariano spokesperson did not answer a news service question about why Lawn did not speak. Instead, Republican Rep. Hannah Kane of Shrewsbury offered a synopsis of the legislation that's expected to save money in the long run by reducing avoidable emergency department visits as patients gain expanded access to preventive care. The bill also requires that commercial insurers reimburse community health centers at the same rate as MassHealth, mandates coverage of mobile integrated health services, creates an accelerated determination of need process for certain community hospital projects, regulates the use of AI in insurance utilization reviews, calls for most manufacturer rebates for prescription drugs to be applied at the pharmacy counter, and boosts oversight of pharmacy benefit managers. Mariano stood at the rostrum for the adoption of two amendments just before 3 p.m., one of which was Lawn Amendment Number 110, that would enable civil actions alleging a defendant sexually abused a minor to commence at any time after the acts alleged to have caused an injury or condition occurred. Lawn, in May, wrote an op-ed in the Boston Globe supporting legislation that would eliminate the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse and reflecting on his own experience as a survivor. There was limited floor discussion of the bill, with the House only kicking into full gear on the primary care bill after 9 p.m. Through private discussions, House leaders ended up combining more than 100 amendments into Consolidated Amendment A. Within the mega amendment, the House adopted policies dealing with biomarker testing and vaccines. Commercial insurers, as well as the Group Insurance Commission and MassHealth, would be required to cover biomarker testing, according to Mariano's office. Oncology providers can use biomarker testing to determine more precise treatments for patients and avoid broader regimens such as chemotherapy and radiation. The amendment updates the responsibilities of the Massachusetts Vaccine Program Advisory Council, which makes recommendations on the types of routine pediatric vaccines the state should buy as part of universal purchasing program. Echoing a House-backed budget policy rider, the amendment also installs a provider immunization brand choice requirement within the purchasing program, enabling participating health care providers to select any brand or type of vaccine that's federally vetted and recommended by the CDC or National Professional Medical Societies. In an effort to tamp down on pharmacy deserts, the House adopted Rep. Christopher Worrell amendment that required the HPC to conduct an assessment at least every 5 years about the supply, distribution, and capacity of pharmacy and pharmacological services. The analysis would identify the number of existing and potential pharmacy deserts defined as the nearest pharmacy located more than 2 miles away in urban areas, more than 5 miles away in suburban areas, and more than 15 miles away in rural areas. Pharmacies that plan to shutter would need to provide at least 60 days' notice to the Board of Registration and Pharmacy, which would review whether the closure is likely to lead to a pharmacy desert. The House and Senate must appoint negotiators to reconcile the policy differences across this primary care packages. Next article. Littleton Coding Manufacturer Acquires Oregon Firm. Aradiance, a Littleton-based manufacturer of specialized coating equipment, has acquired Lotus Applied Technology, an Oregon company known for its research into ultra-thin material coatings. Aradiance builds machines that apply coatings on a few atoms thick onto surfaces such as computer chips, sensors, and other high-tech materials. The process, called atomic layer deposition, allows manufacturers to add precise, ultra-thin protective or functional layers to products used in industries such as semiconductors, energy, and electronics. Lotus will continue operating under its own name as part of Aradiance. Its staff, equipment, and operations will remain unchanged, Aradiance announced. Financial terms were not disclosed. Lotus's speedier coating methods paired with Aradiance's for manufacturing muscle will allow the firm to serve more customers with coatings ready for full-scale production. Founded in 2003 and based at 11A Beaverbrook Road, Ariadne's makes equipment including its GemStar and Prime systems, which are used by commercial, academic, and government researchers to develop new materials for semiconductors, energy devices, sensors, and other emerging technologies. The company runs its own coating service, applying these thin films for customers who need the technology but don't operate their own equipment. The Lotus deal comes as Ariadne's unveiled two new products, Prime Verde and Prime Platinum. These products are aimed at giving customers coating capabilities beyond what's typically available in a research lab, including handling larger materials and more delicate chemical compounds. With the addition of Lotus AT's technology, Ariadne's said it expects to speed the path for these lab-tested coating processes to move into full-scale production for a wider range of manufacturers. And that's all the time we have for today. You have been listening to the Worcester Business Journal, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. That's 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. This is Joanne, reading with Paul. Thank you for listening. And remember, the Worcester Telegram and Gazette will be aired at noon and again at 7 p.m.
Did you know that there are many different ways to listen to Audio Journal? You can go to our website, audiojournal.org, and stream us live. Or you can install the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. Or you can tell your smart speaker to play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or you can dial us at 1-712-770-1043 on your telephone. Or you can turn on your local cable access TV station. You can check our website, audiojournal.org, for the correct channel for your town. And finally, you can use one of our special receivers tuned to Audio Journal's frequency. And if you missed your favorite program, go to our website or the Audio Journal app and listen to podcasts of previously aired programs. Now, if you need assistance with any of these listening methods, please contact us at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Are you elderly or disabled? Did you know each WRTA fixed route bus has a number of accessibility features such as a ramp to enter, a kneeler which can lower the bus, a securement area for wheelchairs and other mobility devices, priority seating for people with disabilities, electronic signage on the front, side, and rear exterior, a bicycle rack on the front exterior, an interior stop request sign, automated audio and visual stop announcements. Let us make your transportation needs easier and ride the bus with us. Call us with questions at 508-791-9782 or visit our website at www.therta.com.
Are you or a loved one losing your vision? Mass Commission for the Blind can help. Reclaim your independence with new skills and assistive technologies. Partner with Mass Commission for the Blind to develop your vision for the future. If you're blind or visually impaired, find out if you're eligible to register for services to help you achieve your career and life goals. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCD. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCD.